And this evening, we take leave of Chumash Vayikra with a parsha of Bichur Kavsai. And the discussion, not surprisingly, begins as soon as the parsha begins. And as soon as we heard the words, Im Bichur Kavsai Telechu, we are already in session. For as we know, Rashi famously quotes from the Teras Kohanim, the words Bichur Kavsai Telechu would seem to be a reference to keeping mitzvos generally. Sounds like Bichur Kavsai Telechu, to walk in my statutes. But the very next phrase in the Pasuk, Ves Mitzvosai Tishmeru, is a general expression itself of keeping mitzvos. So in a sense, we move forward in the Pasuk and then we move backwards. Having seen mitzvos in general, we then return to the opening phrase. And what is Bichur Kavsai Telechu? Says Rashi, quoting the Teras Kohanim, "Shetihiyu amelim b'Torah," to be involved, to be toiling in Torah, and therefore the relationship of these two opening phrases are learning Torah and then keeping mitzvos. And no doubt there are many different angles from which to approach this comment of the Teras Kohanim, but a basic question is, why is it that of all things, learning Torah is referred to as a chok? Bichur Kavsai Telechu. After all, we know that the category of chukim refers specifically to mitzvahs whose reason is beyond us. Statutes, we call them. Paraduma is a chok, and so on and so forth. Is learning Torah a chok? Of all the mitzvahs that are eminently reasonable, learning Torah should be at the top of the list. After all, as we say in Pirkei Avos, Ein bor yirei chet, a person who's ignoramus, how can he fear sin? Godol Talmud shemevi leidei maaseh, if he doesn't learn, how can he perform? It's the most eminently understandable mitzvah. Without Torah knowledge, there's no performance of mitzvahs. Reb Leib Gurewitz Zatzal, the Rosh Hashiva of Gateshead, explains that the reason why Torah learning is called a chok is because the value of Torah learning surpasses and exceeds beyond the knowledge required to fulfill mitzvahs. Rather, learning Torah ultimately is an engagement in itself. It is an involvement in its own right. This is something that is depicted very interestingly in the Talmud, in Maseches Menachos and Daf Tzedek Tes, Amud Beis, which records that the nephew of Rabbi Yishmael, he posed him the following question. He says, take someone like me. I've already mastered the entire Torah. Now I'd like to move on and learn other things. I'd like to learn Greek, Greek philosophy perhaps. So the very petition is interesting. I think we'd look at anyone who claims to have mastered the entire Torah as possibly deluded, and we'd send it back to the beginning again. But Rabbi Yishmael took the claim at face value and says, indeed, you have mastered all of Torah, and now you'd like to learn other things. Here's my recommendation. Here's the schedule that I would set for you. Given that with regards to the mitzvah of learning Torah, the Pasuk states, V'hagisabo yomam v'layla. You should meditate in Torah day and night. Therefore, if you wish to find time for other pursuits, find a time which is neither day nor night. You can do what you want. But if it's either day or night, so you're still in session with learning Torah, because Vagisabo Yomam Valaila. Now, some say that Rabbi Yishmael had an aversion to Greek philosophy per se, and he was looking to do whatever he could to get his nephew away from it. That's the Yerushalmi in Peah seems to indicate that. But the simple reading of the Gemara is that he's saying that even if I believe you, and even if it's true that you know all of Torah, whatever that means, nonetheless, the involvement per se is something that obligates on an ongoing basis. And that gives us to understand that there is much more to what we call learning Torah than merely, quote-unquote, finding out how to fulfill the mitzvahs. Even if you know, we would say, afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nevonim, the mitzvah is in place for itself. Indeed, and this brings us to a delicate question. The relationship of learning Torah to keeping mitzvos. After all, it is certainly true that one does need to learn in order to know. Moreover, when learning, it needs to follow through in the realm of practice. There's no question about that. What we are saying, however, is that it is incorrect, and in fact a severe injustice, to restrict the role of learning Torah to the information that will bring you to mitzvah fulfillment. As Rabbi Yisrael Salanter points out in one of his letters, it's a delicate phraseological issue, but we have a concept that we call lilmod amanas lasos. That's a concept in Pirkei Avos and elsewhere. Lilmod amanas lasos. That phrase is very important because the words almanas mean conditional upon. That's what almanas means, conditional upon. And it is true. Learning Torah is conditional upon fulfilling its mitzvahs. The Talmud says elsewhere in Maseches Yevamos and Daf Kuf Tes, if a person says, I have only Torah, he doesn't even have Torah because he's missed the whole point. He says he has only Torah and not mitzvahs. He doesn't have anything because that's not Torah if it's not followed through. Almanas lasos, conditional upon fulfilling mitzvahs. However, says Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, no one ever spoke about lilmod kidei lasos, in order to fulfill mitzvahs. It's such a nuanced point, but it makes all the difference. Because conditional upon means that indeed the mitzvahs are a necessity and a necessary follow through. But Talmud Torah is its own thing. Had it said lilmod kidei lasos, the implication is that the subtotal of the learning is to bring you only to mitzvahs. That's not true. Learning Torah is its own mitzvah. In fact, it is one of the 613 mitzvahs. And moreover, we say Talmud Torah keneged kulam. In fact, I came across a very interesting comment of the Chasam Sofer in his Peirush to Maseches Nedarim. And he talks about the concept of Torah Lishma. And Torah Lishma is very elusive. It's easy to extol its virtues and never find out what it actually means. Torah for its own sake. I mean, what exactly is the meaning there? And there are many interpretations, and these are famous discussions that take place, the Baal HaTanya and the Nefesh HaChaim and others. But the Chasam Sofer says, perhaps disarmingly simply, that the concept of Torah Lishma means this very point, that a person recognizes the inherent and intrinsic value of learning Torah as its own enterprise. Lishma, for its own value, as if to say, not just something that takes him to the fulfillment of mitzvot. That's called Torah Lishma. And moreover, we can see the difference between the two relationships with learning Torah. How do we see it? His comments are on the Gemara there in Maseches Nedarim. It's a well-known statement. Commenting on the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Alma Avda Haaretz, over what was the land lost? That's the Haftorah for Tisha B'Av morning. Alma Avda Haaretz. How did the loss of the land and the destruction of everything, how did that happen? And the Gemara goes through and expounds and explains. And finally, the Gemara identifies the cause of the problem. In the famous words of the Gemara, Shelo berchu batorah tchila. They didn't make a bracha before they learned Torah. Now, as we can appreciate, that diagnosis needs inspection. Because, and to say it correctly, with all due respect to the importance of Birchas HaTorah, all brachas are important, and maybe bracha on learning Torah is more important. But how can it be the most important? How can that be the cause of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? Especially as we're aware from elsewhere in the Talmud, in Maseches Yuma and Daf Tes, with regards to the cause of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, it is traced back to three of the biggest sins of which we are aware, the three cardinal sins, idol worship and adultery and bloodshed, Avodah Zarah, Gilah Arayos and Shefichas Damim. That's the well-known causes that are mentioned there in the first Beis HaMikdash, as opposed to the second, which was Sinas Chinam. But the first one is those three big averas. How can you possibly hold up not making a bracha before learning to those three other major infractions? And moreover, the implication seems to be that people were learning Torah. No one said they weren't learning. It sounds like they didn't make a bracha before they learned. So, I mean, they started, they're dabbling on page 5 instead of page 3. I mean, that's what it sounds like. How is that responsible for everything? And the Chasam Sofer explains, really, shall we say, ultimately, what led to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash were all those terrible things. And they're unavoidable. And you cannot ascribe it to anything else once those things happen. If there's murder, and if there's adultery, and if there's avodah zarah, you need to look no further. The Gemara doesn't look further, but the Gemara looks deeper. Because the question in Maseches Nedarim is, okay, in the end, people have deteriorated to that stage. But how did they deteriorate to that stage? As if to say, were they not learning Torah? And is it not true that learning Torah has qualities and properties to protect and to elevate and to save a person from falling prey to such thing, from deteriorating to such a stage? And that really is the question at the inception level, at the root level. How did it all begin? How did it reach those terrible practices? And to that, the Gemara answers as follows. They didn't make a bracha before they learned. And what does that mean? What's that a reflection of? Or what's that an expression of? Says the Chasam Sofer, we have a principle when it comes to making brachas. As we know, there's many things that we call mitzvos, but there's a certain point before which you don't make a bracha. If we would say building a sukkah, we call it a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah involvement. But you don't make a bracha when you build a sukkah. Because the mitzvah is leishev sukkah, to dwell in the sukkah. If you don't build, you can't dwell. But that doesn't make the building the mitzvah. It's what's called a hechsher mitzvah, an enabling act. It gets you to the mitzvah. Likewise, baking matzahs. Again, we call it a mitzvah. People make time for it. But there's no bracha made when you bake a matzah. Well, why not? Because the mitzvah is al achilas matzah. If you don't bake, you can't eat. But that doesn't make baking the mitzvah. Again, it's a hechsher mitzvah. It enables you. It gets you to the mitzvah. But if you ever want to know where is the mitzvah, look for the bracha. Wherever the bracha is, there you know where the mitzvah is. The dwelling in the sukkah. The eating of the matzah. And now, let us turn our attention to learning Torah. And ask, what is learning Torah? Is it just a means to get you to the mitzvahs? If that's true, it's like baking a matzah. You didn't bake, you can't eat. If you don't learn, you can't perform. But is it no more? Or is it perhaps its own mitzvah? How can you tell? Look at the bracha. Lo berchu b'Torah tchila. If they didn't make a bracha before they learned, they say, we appreciate learning, because without learning, how can we do mitzvahs? But to make a bracha on learning? Why? We're not yet doing a mitzvah. That means that what they were missing was Torah Lishma. They do not recognize the intrinsic value of learning for as its own mitzvah. So, says Chasam Sofer, all of the properties that accrue and exist within learning Torah, protective and elevating, and all of those things, they only exist for a person who appreciates learning for what it is. If you don't have that appreciation, you don't get those dividends. That is a klal gadol with regards to Torah living. The less you perceive in it, the more you'll receive from it. The less you'll receive from it, I mean to say. And therefore, if the question is, why did their Torah learning not protect them? The answer is because they didn't appreciate Torah learning as its own thing. Just information to get you to mitzvahs. So it doesn't protect you more than other mitzvahs do. And that wasn't enough. And that is how they deteriorated to the state that they did. And this brings us back to the beginning of our parsha, Im b'chukosai teilechu. Learning Torah is called a chok, because as much as there's an aspect that's intuitive, very much so, if you don't learn, you can't do mitzvahs, but that's not the subtotal of what learning Torah is. It's more than that. It's its own commitment, its own involvement, and its own value, because it represents an ongoing connection with a person on a cerebral level with the Torah. I recall my father, Zatzal, once said, remarked, there's a passing comment. He said, people think that who's a good rabbi? A good rabbi is someone who's learned a lot. Verlernt, they say. He's someone who's learned a lot. But my father said, a good rabbi is not someone who's learned a lot. A good rabbi is someone who learns a lot. It's so counter to the way people relate to information and expertise. But the level of the rabbi is in the learning that continues, not just the learning that he has amassed until that point. So these are certainly worthwhile sentiments in the days and weeks leading up to Matan Torah, especially as our finest hour, so to say, with regards to receiving the Torah, was when we said Na'aseh V'Nishma. And Na'aseh V'Nishma, if we ponder it for a moment, is backwards. Because Na'aseh means we'll perform, and Nishma means we'll listen, but if you perform before you listen, you'll probably do something wrong, or you have no idea what you're doing. You can't perform before you listen. Should it not have said Nishma V'Na'aseh, the commitment? We'll listen, and we undertake to do whatever it is that we've heard. So why is it reversed? Why does it say Na'aseh and then Nishma? Says the Beis Halevi, because it's this very point. Had the formula been Nishma V'Na'aseh, we'll listen and we'll perform, the understanding would have been, we're prepared to listen in order to perform, and that's what listening to words of Torah is all about. But when you invert the order, really what you're saying is, we'll perform the mitzvahs, including everything we need to know to perform the mitzvahs, and we'll still listen to words of Torah. The learning Torah after you know enough to perform the mitzvah, that's called Torah Lishma. That's called Na'aseh V'Nishma. So these are certainly very timely matters and well worth our reflection and always worth reminding ourselves. Well, what happens in Bechukosai Teleichu if you keep the mitzvahs? Parshas Bechukosai is famous for its tochacha. It's famous for the warnings of things that go wrong. But we shouldn't forget that it starts with all the things that will go right. There are brachos and klalos. And the opening psukim are the rewards promised by the Torah for keeping the mitzvahs. And what are those rewards? The first pasuk says, as we're saying, if you're learning Torah, toiling in Torah, ve'es mitzvosai tishmeru, keeping mitzvahs. And the second pasuk says, ve'nosati gishmechem bi'itam. I will give the reins in their time. This pasuk is a juncture for a major discussion that begins with Rishonim, continues into the Acharonim, possibly until our time. Namely, if you would ask anyone, what is the reward for keeping mitzvahs? Any child who's received a basic Torah education, he will say that we can expect it if we keep mitzvahs. So then what does a person expect from keeping mitzvahs? That he'll have a place in Olam Haba, that's what it's all about, ultimately. Yet we never find that the Torah makes or presents this as the end goal of keeping mitzvahs. In its stead, we find rather more temporal rewards. Rain in its time is most welcome, but is that the ultimate reward for keeping mitzvahs? And this question is discussed, as we said already, Niftach Barishonim, Chovos Havavos, and others. And I'd like to present, of the many answers, just two or three, just to have something to ponder with regards to this. And as we'll appreciate, the question is twofold. Firstly, why does the Torah not make mention of Olam Haba, which is its own question? And secondly, why does it, yes, present the result of keeping mitzvos as these very temporal things? Good rainfall, plenty, good harvest, and all of that, as we can appreciate, they are two separate points in the question, because the Torah could have just said nothing. So we need to examine why it didn't say what it didn't say, and then why it did say what it did. And this question is actually discussed by the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva. Many of the lofty, idealistic aspects of Judaism are actually discussed at the end of Hilchos Tshuva. Hilchos Tshuva of the Rambam is not just about doing tshuva. It starts with that, but in the end it's about free will, and it's about reward and punishment, about many, many other things. And here too, certainly, the Rambam gives what you could call, hopefully, meaningfully, a very idealistic answer to this question. Why does the Torah not speak about the reward of Olam Haba for mitzvahs? And the Rambam says, because the Torah does not wish to focus on reward for mitzvahs. The point of mitzvahs is not to get their reward. Here, the Rambam is invoking the general concept of lishma, that is to say, mitzvahs for their own sake. As Antigonus tells us in Pirkei Avos, not to be like servants who serve amanas lekabel pras, rather, shelo amanas lekabel pras. And the Rambam develops this very, very fervently, one could say. The idea that ultimately, if something is the highest good and the highest way that one should live, then that alone is compelling reason, as opposed to, and what reward will I get if I do this? There is reward, but that shouldn't be the focus, because it takes away from the truth of a person's involvement in fulfilling Hashem's wishes and Hashem's command. Now that's a chiddush, I think, because in a sense, it's because of the idealistic nature of this answer, the Torah prefers not to mention the reward, to remove focus from reward. You may ask, says Rambam, so if you don't want to focus on reward, so why did you mention something else in its stead? Why did you say good harvest, good rainfall, plenty, and all of that? And here Rambam famously says, all the things that Torah mentions, and interestingly, we focus on it annually in the Bichur Kosai, but it's in Shema every day. Im Shema Tishma'ol Mitzvosai, V'nosati Metaretzichem Bi'ito, V'asavta Diganecha, that direct correlation between keeping mitzvahs will lead to plenty and abundance and blessing and all of that. But what's that for? Says Rambam, that's not reward for mitzvahs. Reward for mitzvahs doesn't come with grain. But when the Torah says, if the Jewish people keep mitzvahs, then Hashem will provide them with plenty, says Rambam, that's something else. That's the concept of mitzvah gereres mitzvah. Namely, when a person does something, when a person indicates, or when the Jewish people indicate with their actions that they're prepared to be devoted to following Hashem's wishes, so Hashem gives them the wherewithal to make it all the easier for them to do that. After all, says Rambam, a person could be hampered in doing the right thing, parnasa and all of that, if he doesn't have food to eat, that he can't function as highly as he can, even in Jewish terms. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if you show and if you demonstrate that you are committed to keeping Torah and mitzvahs, so I'll make it easier for you, because with a good harvest and rain in its time, all your needs will be taken care of in order to further allow you to devote yourself to those things. But menuchas hanefesh, and certainly for Rambam, where a very major part of Torah living is the contemplation and deep understanding of things. A person cannot understand something deeply if he's got worries and someone's calling the whole time and so on and so forth. And therefore, that is the Rambam's famous understanding of what the Torah means by promising all those things. You're in, so I'll make it easier for you. And then that will take you further in. The reward, that will come later. In the meanwhile, we're talking about keeping mitzvahs. And even the rainfall is about keeping mitzvahs. And the harvest is about keeping mitzvahs. With good rainfall and good harvest, your path will be clear to keep mitzvahs to the optimum. But there is a follow-up point, which is very interesting. And that is that the premise of the Rambam is the easier life is, the easier it will, the more enhanced will your fulfillment of mitzvahs will be. That's not always true. Because there are some people who, when life gets easier, their fulfillment of mitzvahs slips or fades or goes back a stage or two. It's an interesting phenomenon. As if to say, there's some people, they're at their holiest when they're at their neediest. But as soon as things look good in the office, so you'll never see them again. And how then does that fit in with saying that if you keep the mitzvahs, so there'll be a good rain and a good harvest? What if it's a person who, as soon as there's a good rain and a good harvest, they become obsessed with the harvest? And the blessing becomes a curse. But that is why the Torah prefaces this whole blessing and in a sense, cause and effect to promote further mitzvah observance with the words, Bechukosai Teilechu. And Bechukosai Teilechu, again, as the Torah's Kohanim said, means Amelim Batorah, toiling in Torah. it only rains when people toil in Torah. And what if they're learning, but they're not toiling in Torah? What if they're keeping mitzvahs, but not in a particularly dedicated way? These brachas don't apply? The answer is perhaps not. Because if people are keeping mitzvahs, shall we say, in a way which doesn't really demonstrate firm commitment, it might not be in their best interest, even spiritually, to give them a good harvest. Because a good harvest might sweep them away. And the little they were doing, that's the last you see of it. And therefore, there is a proviso. If you're firmly committed, so you're a person that a good harvest will only bring out better things, Torah-wise, from you. More, not less. These are also very interesting points to ponder. And this is, again, to summarize in one sentence, the Rambam's position. Why does the Torah not mention Olam Haba? Don't focus on reward. Why does it mention Olam Hazeh? That's still about keeping mitzvahs. Interestingly, Ramban, before we move to one of the very fascinating answers of the Acharonim, but the Ramban says that actually, if the question is, why did the Torah not say if you keep mitzvahs that you'll get a portion in the world to come? The Torah actually said more than that. The Torah has said more than that. Where? By saying, if you keep mitzvahs, then there will be rain in its time and a plentiful harvest. Why is that more than Olam Haba? It's not a greater reward, but it's a bigger chiddush. Because when you think about it, says Ramban, generally speaking, in the world of cause and effect, the nature of the cause will determine the nature of the effect. If there are spiritual realms and spiritual matters and physical matters, it's fair to say spiritual cause will breed a spiritual effect. Physical cause will breed a physical effect. Which means if mitzvahs are spiritual acts and have spiritual content, then to say that they would bring about a spiritual effect is very straightforward. I mean, that's intuitive in the realms of spiritual things. The chiddush of the Torah is that keeping mitzvahs will lead to a good harvest. It's a bigger chiddush, because in a sense, the nature of the cause has crossed over domains into a different realm and bred an effect in something else entirely. Because really what we're saying is, spiritual cause not only breeds spiritual effect, but even physical effect. The interface or the translation of Torah input into harvest output, that's a bigger chiddush than saying Torah input into spiritual output. And therefore, the Ramban feels that the things that the Torah stated are actually a much greater chiddush than spiritual reward, as is expressed by Olam Haba. So that is the approach of the Ramban. But I would like to conclude just this segment of the discussion by referring to the comments of Reb Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin. Reb Tzadok HaKohen, very, very unusual person in many respects. He began life as a misnagid, and then he visited Lublin and fell under the spell of the Chozer of Lublin, and that was the end of that. And he became a devoted adherent of his and became one of a Rebbe himself. The writings of Reb Tzadok of Lublin are enigmatic. He doesn't give his secrets up easily, sometimes not at all. But just to get a nugget of how Reb Tzadok explains. And what is it based on? The Zohar states that with regards to the relationship between the Torah and the world, the Torah and existence. So the Zohar puts it quite plainly, that existence is modeled on the Torah. It's a well-known expression, but it shouldn't be worn out or under justified. That the Torah is the blueprint of creation. In the words of the Zohar, Istakel ba'araisa ubara alma. Hashem looked into the Torah and created the world. And that means that the world, all spheres of existence, begin. The Torah is almost like the first creation, and it becomes the energy from which all other aspects of creation exist. So, we have mentioned on many occasions that there are different levels of meaning that come out from the Torah. Some things are straightforward reading and translation. Other things need to be expounded. Other things are alluded to, and so on and so forth. These are known as the pardes, pshat, remez, drash, and sod, many different levels. And as different Meforshim discuss in different ways, why are there different levels? Why not just say everything Pshat? Or and so on and so forth. Does it make a difference if something is there blatantly in the Pasuk? Or needs to be expounded? Or is alluded to? Does it reflect a different nature of that thing? So the Meforshim say it does. Because just like reality itself, there are certain things that are closer to the surface and certain things that are more deeply embedded, and that's why the Pasuk also has those layers. Because when it describes, for example, any given situation, it has the Pshat, and the Pshat of the words, what meets the eye when you read the words, reflects what would meet the eye had you been in that situation. And what is yielded from a deeper investigation into the words is what you would fathom from a deeper investigation into that situation. For example, Bilam. If you look in the Torah, if you look at the simple reading of the Psukim, the only words he seems to say are quite devout sounding. He sounds quite frum in many ways. If Balak would give me a house full of gold and silver, I could never violate Hashem's words. And from a certain point of view, he means it. So that's interesting, because we know that Bilam is a very not such a good person at all. And you look in Pirkei Avos, and he's in it's ayin ra'ah and all of those things, mean spirited and a terrible person. But it's an interesting blend in a sense, because the psukim themselves don't overtly seem to portray him that way. But of course, we know that he is that way, and if you look deeper in the psukim, you can see and so on and so forth. But why is it that way? So the Mefarshim say, because that's what Bilam was like. If you had just 5 minutes with Bilam, you'd ask him for a bracha. He's a Rebbe. And if you didn't look beyond the surface of Bilam, you'd think he's the firmest person around. But if you look deeper, if you paid attention to nuance and to expressions and so on and so forth, you'd get a deeper sense of Bilam. You'd see there's a lot going on beneath the surface. Everything that's beneath the surface of Bilam is beneath the surface in the Pasuk. That's the correlation between those two. That's called the Pshat register. As if to say, when something registers in reality, it registers in the Pshat. If you need to fathom it and draw it out, you have to draw it out from the Pasuk also. And that is true not only with regards to events, but ultimately, if we say that the world is modeled on the Torah, or the world is drawn out from the Torah, and we see that there are certain things that are explicit in the Torah and certain things that are implicit. And if it's explicit in the Torah, it's manifest in reality. And if it's implicit in the Torah, so it is not manifest in physical reality, even though it's very much there. Says Rav Tzadok, so now you know why the Torah does not give overt expression or discuss explicitly the concept of Olam Haba. Because anything that is discussed explicitly in the Torah, if it's explicit in the Pasuk, it's manifest in reality. But in this world, many things can be manifest in this world. But one thing that cannot be manifest in this world is the next world. Because they are two so completely different planes of existence, almost antithetical to each other. And therefore, it's in the nature of Olam, to put it into one sentence, and it's really, there's much to ponder here. It's the nature of Olam Haba that it cannot exist in Olam Hazeh. The world to come cannot be in this world. The two so different planes. And because it cannot exist overtly in this world, it cannot be spoken about overtly in the Pasuk, because that's where all of existence derives from. So these, again, that's a rather esoteric approach to this question, and there's many other approaches, Mitzvah Hashem, which we'll leave for another time, but certainly much to think about there. So we cannot stay on the brachas forever. We need to move into the tochacha itself. And I'd like to focus actually on a pasuk towards the end of the tochacha. And that is pasuk membeis. Okay, the tochacha is a good number of psukim. Of my three sons who have already been bar mitzvah, two of them had the parsha of Bechukosai. So I've had occasion to listen to these psukim many times. But there's always something to glean, of course, as we know. And here we have pasuk membeis, and we'll read it carefully. Again, we say it in the davening also, the slichus and so on. Towards the end. V'zocharti es brisi Yaakov, says Hashem. Terrible, terrible things have happened. The Jewish people have begun a little bit to take stock of things and to expiate for their wrongdoings. V'zocharti es brisi Yaakov. Then I'll remember my covenant with Yaakov. V'af es brisi Yitzchak. And also my covenant with Yitzchak. V'af es brisi Abraham Eskor. And also my covenant with Avram. V'haaretz Eskor. And the land I will remember. Now, of course, the first thing that strikes us, just as we read the pasuk, as we know how to go through the three avos, we never have them backwards. I believe this is the only time in the Torah that the avos are mentioned backwards. It's always Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, or Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yisrael. But here, I remember my bris with Yaakov, and my bris with Yitzchak, and my bris with Avraham. Why are the avos mentioned in reverse order? That's a simple question. Rashi addresses that question, in fact. A further point, again for the Baal Koreh, is that if you look at the word Yaakov, and under the kuf, you have that tam, which is known as an esnachta, v'zocharti esprisi Yaakov, an esnachta. As we know, the esnachta, as its name suggests, is a very strong pause. It's like lahavdol, but it's like a semicolon, really. It's the strongest pause outside of the end of a sentence. And it's the strongest pause within a sentence. The question is, just to take a step back, if we may ask such a question, why would you pause there? As if to say, what are you talking about? You're talking about Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, or Yaakov, Yitzhak, and Avram, in whatever order you wish to have them. But it's hardly appropriate to pause when you just mentioned the first of the three. If you want, pause after, have you mentioned all three? And then the end, the Aretz Eskor, something like that. But you're just starting mentioning the others. It's an interesting shaila. We don't normally have shailas on the Tamiya Mikra, whatever's in the Chumash, that's what there is. But it's worthwhile asking. And this question is raised by Rav Hirsch. And he actually prefaces his answer to this question by asking another question. And that is, what is the meaning? It's very interesting to consider. The meaning of the expression, Brisi Yaakov, Brisi Yitzchak, Brisi Avram. Hashem says, I'll remember all those things. Now, I think we will normally translate those expressions as my covenant with Yaakov, my covenant with Yitzchak, my covenant with Avram. I believe that's correct, and I'm sure that's how it's translated in the standard translations. But that is not a strict translation. That's not what the words are saying. The words don't say, because to say my covenant with Yaakov would be, v'zacharti es brisi im Yaakov. That's my covenant with Yaakov, my covenant with Avram, and so on and so forth. That's an interesting shaila. And that's why Rav Hirsch says something which is quite remarkable here. Namely, these expressions, Brisi Yaakov, Brisi Yitzchak, Brisi Avram, they're not a covenant with Yaakov, or with Yitzchak, or with Avram. They're covenants. There are three types of covenant. One's called my Yaakov covenant, my Yitzchak covenant, and my Avram covenant. There's three types of covenant, and they're covenants with the Jewish people. The question is, what is the meaning of that? What's the meaning of having a Yaakov covenant, and a Yitzchak covenant, and an Avram covenant? Says Rav Hirsch, if you look at the lives of the Avos, and again, we're far from Bereishis, so you could take a look back. Just ponder, contemplate for a moment. Their lives were very different from each other. Avram, for example, sees by and large success. And not only does he see success, but he receives acclaim. An accord. Even those B'nai Ches, they call him a prince of God. No one's going to be called that for a long time. But Avram is called that. And he's honored wherever he goes. He has his difficulties. But he's successful. And he is appreciated and recognized. What about Yitzchak? Yitzchak is also successful. You look in Parshas Toldos, Me'er Sha'arim, extremely successful. But unlike Avram, his success is not accompanied by acclaim on the part of his neighbors. On the contrary, it generates ill will, and he has to move the whole time. People begrudge his success. With Avram, they applauded his success. With Yitzhak, they begrudge his success. What about Yaakov? Yaakov has from what the Pasuk talks about openly with Yaakov, difficult times, almost from beginning to end. first, with it's from one thing to another. First Esau, then Lavan, then Rachel dies, and then the whole thing with Yosef, with Dinah, all these things. And it's a lot of very difficult things. Those are the experiences, again, we're generalizing, but they are the experiences contrasted of the three Avos. But they are the Avos, and they are the beginnings of the Jewish people, and that means that they set templates for different planes of experience that the Jewish people may have. And that's why, interestingly, when we have the traditions from the Gemara in the fourth parak of Brachos, that the three daily Shemona Esreis were originally instituted by Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And which tefillah goes to which Av? Avram institutes Shachris. Because Avram is Shachris. His life is Shachris. His life is morning. The morning time, the sun is shining, it's only getting better. So Avram's life is like a Shachris type of life. And that's the tefillah that he institutes. Yitzchak is interesting because it's mincha time. It's still day, but as the pasuk describes, lifnos erev, evening is coming. There's aspects of evening there. It's not the glow of the morning. Yitzchak institutes mincha. Yaakov, ma'ariv, that's night. And as Mishnah Chachma points out in Parshas VaYigash, Hashem only ever appears to Yaakov at night. It always says so, but Vayigash appears to him at night. And Yaakov becomes, in a sense, associated with the Jewish people as they go through their nighttime experiences. And that's why we say, in Lam Natseach, Yan Hashem Biyom Tzara, a day of Tzara, Yisagevcha, who will help you? Elokei Yaakov. Only Elokei Yaakov? Yeah, because then you're like Yaakov if you're going through difficult times. I mean, that's, and it's Masa Avos. And each one, in a sense, set the foundations for the Jewish people because he forged a connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, again, on the level of the Avos, in his situation. And the Jewish people themselves can undergo such situations. Says Rav Hirsch, by the time the Tochacha is over, you're talking about a Yaakov-type experience. That's night. That's tochacha. That's full golos. But what does the pasuk describe? When does it end? And what's demanded of the Jewish people? They can't always get themselves out of it. But there's a covenant between Hashem and them in times of golos. And what's that covenant called? It's called the Yaakov covenant. It's called Brisi Yaakov. And what does it mean? It means that as difficult as things are, that they need to maintain their connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even in such times. And that's why, and that's what's really, whenever they take stock and say, you know, we have to do better. If we don't do better, we're not going to get out of this. That's because we're still connected to Hashem, and He still has expectations of us, and we need to come forward. That's called honoring Brisi Yaakov. You've got to act like Yaakov, even during the nighttime. And that's the first thing the Jewish people do. And that's why Hashem says, V'zacharti es brisi Yaakov. And I'll remember my covenant, my Yaakov covenant. If they remember the Yaakov covenant, I'll remember the Yaakov covenant. And after the word Yaakov, or accompanying it, is an esnachta. It's a pause. Why? Because it is the correct place to pause, because we're in the Yaakov situation, which means it's almost like a summation of everything that's just happened. So what happens when Hashem remembers his brisi Yaakov? Things get better for the Jewish people. They graduate, so to speak. This is why the Avos are mentioned in reverse order, because they move from a Yaakov covenant to a Yitzchak covenant. And what does it mean? It means that things gradually get better for them. As opposed to being downtrodden and persecuted, they begin to become successful. But their success is not without negative fallout from their surroundings, where are they? They're in Yitzhak now. They're like Yitzhak. He was successful, but his success was begrudged by those around. And what is the covenant of Yitzhak? The covenant of Yitzhak is that as much as people begrudge his success, but the way forward in life is not to curry favor with them, it's to be faithful to the way Hashem wants him to be. And everything else will fall into line. And when it does, that's the final graduation to Brisi Avram. It means to remain faithful when all is well and the Jewish people are yet recognized and valued for what they are. And it really is a fascinating comment, because when one ponders our own recent history, one can really see that we have moved from Brisi Yaakov. We've moved up. But I think it's fair to say that we're currently in Brisi Yitzchak, in the sense that we're in the Yitzchak zone. Baruch Hashem, the Jewish people, and certainly in the land of Israel, incredibly successful, but not appreciated. We're not in the Avram stage, we're in the Yitzchak stage. There's no lack of Philistines in all of their forms, looking to vilify and to paint a negative light every success that the Jewish people have. That's Brisi Yitzchak. And it's a very delicate stage, because we want to move forward towards Avram. But how do we do that? We have a covenant called Brisi Yitzchak. Brisi Yitzchak means that you have to do the right thing. You don't wish to agitate for the sake of it anyone else, but your first commitment is to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if you honor that commitment, then you move from Yitzchak to Avram, and everything will take care of itself. It's a vexing issue. It's an ongoing issue. How do we do it? It's a terribly upsetting thing in the eyes of many people or groups or whatever. The Jewish people can do no right, and as successful as they are, vayikanu b'em plishtim, vayikanu b'em plishtim. The plishtim become jealous, and we dig wells and they fill them up again, hampering at every stride. But what we do not wish to do is say, if only, and I only mean this in the pure sense as far as Torah is concerned, if only we could bring the plishtim on side and make them our friends, then they'd be happy for us. They'll never be happy for us. They will appreciate what we are as long as we remain true to what we are. That's our commitment between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's how the Tochacha ends. Certainly, again, a great deal straight from Parshas Bechukos, and we are living in the middle. I think it's fair to say we're in the middle of Pasuk Mem Beis of this. I'd just like to conclude with a statement or comment from Rav Leib Hyman, and he takes us to the end of Parshas Bechukosai, the concluding pasuk, in fact. Eila HaMitzvahs, this is Perek of Zayin Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Eila HaMitzvahs, these are the mitzvahs. Asher Tziva Hashem es Moshe al Bnei Yisrael Bahar Sinai. That's how it ends. Concluding Pasuk. The Teras Kohanim, in its comment here on this final Pasuk, takes each and every phrase of the Pasuk and has something to say on it. Eila HaMitzvahs, what does that mean? Hashem is Moshe, Moshe's relationship with Hashem, Moshe's relationship with Bnei Yisrael. And on the word El Bnei Yisrael, says the Teras Kohanim, Zechus Yisrael Garma. It is the merit of the Jewish people that brought all this about. El Bnei Yisrael, that's how it ends off, Bahar Sinai. And what's very interesting about this, explanation of Rav Hyman, and we have had occasion to quote Rav Leib Hyman Zatzal many times over the course of these years. He was the Rav of the Groshel, Bekneset Agra, that is to say, in Bayit Began. There's a few, you have to say where. The Bekneset Agra in Bayit Began. And he became the Rav there in 1981 after a number of years that no one had become the Rav, because the previous Rav there was Rav Yechezkel Abramsky. And it took a long time before anyone was happy with someone coming in to fill his shoes. But the one they chose was Rav Leib Hyman. And his inaugural address to the shul was Motzei Shabbos Parshas Bechukosai, 1981. And he spoke then about this Teras Kohanim. Because the Torah Deskonim says you've got the mitzvahs and you've got Moshe and Hashem is speaking to Moshe and Moshe is communicating to the Jewish people. And the Torah Deskonim says Zechus Yisrael Garma. The merit of the Jewish people brought all this about. It's in their merit that Hashem speaks to Moshe and gives him the Torah to the Jewish people. And what's so fascinating about this, says Rav Hyman, often when you get to the end, you look back to the beginning. So when you get to the end of Vayikra, look back to the beginning of Vayikra, you'll find something interesting. Because what you'll find is the very same message in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Vayikra El Moshe. Hashem speaks to Moshe, Vayidab Hashem Eilav, Me'ol Mo'ed Le'mor. Back to Vayikra. Rashi commenting on the words Le'mor, quotes the Teras Kohanim. Go out and say to them, Bishvilchem hu nidbayimi. It's because of you. It's for your sake Hashem speaks to me. That's the Le'mor. Tell the Jewish people, everything I'm saying to you is because of them. It's for their sake that I speak to you. You see, when the Jewish people are in Nidui, so to speak, when they fall from grace during those middle 38 years, Hashem doesn't speak to Moshe in the same way, because the Jewish people need to be on level for Hashem to speak to Moshe. It turns out that Chumash Vayikra ends the way it began, by reminding us that everything, because Moshe, of course, as a person, is the central personality in Vayikra, and indeed in the Torah, that you have to remember, and it only enhances the picture, Zuchus Yisrael Garma. It's the merit of the Jewish people that for whose purposes and for whose sake HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Moshe in the way that he does and communicates the mitzvahs to them. Certainly well worth thinking about any time there's appreciation. And we find all the Chumashim in their own way begin with an appreciation of the Jewish people. Bereshis, Bishvil Yisrael, Shenik Rereshis. The world is created for the Jewish people. Shemos begins with Shemos B'nai Yisrael, mentions them one by one. Vayikra, Hashem speaks to Moshe for Yisrael. Bamidbar, Hashem counts the Jewish people the whole time. Mitoch chibason, out of love. Devarim, it's words of rebuke, but it's stated in the concealed form out of honor for the Jewish people. That's where the first pasuk is, just a series of places, respect for the Jewish people. It's a thread that runs through the entire Torah, and of all the messages that we receive from the Torah, from reading its verses, if we take a step back and get that symphonic message from the tone that's set for all the five chumashim, that's certainly worthwhile absorbing as well. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Chazak, chazak. Chazak.